Thank you, David. I appreciate that word of prayer. I should specify why I told David about us being married for 41 years. It's not so much to speak of our expertise, but I think what you'll discover over the next day or tonight and tomorrow morning is this. If this couple can make it, anybody can make it, right? We have a miniature version of our seminar in which we say, here's what all we did over the last 41 years. Don't do that, okay? But we have anything less than a conventional marriage. But about 10 years ago, we were given the opportunity to conduct a marriage seminar at our home congregation where I was the pulpit preacher at the time. And because of my connection with the School of Preaching in Denver, I had several of our graduates and said, hey, would you come do that material? So it was never intended for us to get in the quote-unquote seminar business. We kind of fell into it. So after 16 years of local work, we began this work, and God's been really good to us. And folks just like you have been extremely good about not just attending and participating, but encouraging us along the way. And so we're thankful that you're here tonight. I need to give all of you men a little bit of instruction, and that's this. Relax, okay? I know how guys are coming to a marriage seminar. They expect that they're going to have to stand up and confess all their marital woes. I always say that's for the drive home. Don't worry about it. She'll work that out for you. And for others, I said, you think you're going to have to get up and do one of those teary-eyed, you know, restate your vows to your wife while all of your friends look on going, what a crybaby. We're not going to do that either. That's for on the way home as well. We want you to have an encouraging time together. We want you to be encouraged in your marriage. But really, our material, I don't know that it's anything revolutionary except for this. A few years back, and maybe I need to kind of give a little bit of background, with five kids, our life was constant turmoil. I mean, it was the kids came home from school, they got a little bit of playtime, there was a little bit of time to work on their homework, maybe they had some chores to do, and then we had dinner, and then it was clean up, finish up the homework, a little bit of the rest of the chores that needed to be done, maybe some TV time or some playtime, and then it was bedtime, we have kind of an argument. I thought bedtime was at 8:30, Tammy said it was at 7:30, my kids thought it was at 9:30, at least that's the time they finally started going to sleep. By 10 o'clock, Tammy and I finally had everybody down, everybody was quiet, and you would think that would be our time as a couple together, but it wasn't. Tammy retreats to the bathroom to take an hour-long bath. I don't know what happens in there. Sometimes I hear her singing, and sometimes she's laughing. A lot of times she's in there crying. I don't know what all's going on in there. I just get to catch up on my television programs while she's there. And then at 11 o'clock, she would come out, and we had our first real interactive time, just the two of us, until we realized it was midnight, right? A new day was about to start, and we needed to go to bed and be ready to greet. So that was our routine when our kids were growing up. When our kids got grown, that maybe is not, that's a misnomer. When they got older, a couple of them are still working on growing up, but when they got older and moved out, our routine stayed the same. We would find that on a particular night, I'd be like tired on the couch. I'm just like barely holding my eyes open. She's barely holding her eyes open. I'd go, aren't you going to go take a bath tonight? She goes, it's only 9:58. I mean, she's waiting till 10 o'clock. And so she gets up to take her bath and she comes out of the bath. And I don't want, I'll just tell you right now, I'm not going to invite you into my bedroom and I'm not going to be presumptuous, invite myself into yours. But you need to know this about Tammy. Tammy is always beautiful, but her beauty changes. When she goes to the bath, out comes her contact lenses, and she has this pair of glasses that she got like in the third grade that she puts on. They're kind of a little bit cattywampus there. And her natural curly hair, because of the steam of the bath, becomes this naturally kinky hair. It's like this little helmet on her head. And she, and I don't want to, let's see, how do I do this diplomatically with her sitting right here? in this phase of life that she's in, the bath is really, really hot. So when she gets out of it, she puts on a lightweight nightgown, but she doesn't want to get cold. So she puts on a flannel pajama top, this pink stripe thing. But at the same time, she doesn't want to get too hot. So she turns the air conditioner. It's a complex thing. And then she always comes out. She's got some book that she wants to read. It's usually something thick about something obscure like vampire riding unicorns or something. I mean, it's weird books and everything. And she comes out and she says, I'm not ready for bed yet. And I said, I'm exhausted. So she's going to stay up and read. And she's trying to keep up with me in age. So she has a pair of reading glasses that she puts on to read in front of her other glasses. So here she is. She's got two. And by the way, that book has a book light that doesn't shine on the page. It shines right in my eye. That's how this is. So that's the scene. And she leans over. She kisses me goodnight. And I kind of slur out, I love you. And she kind of laughs and says, I love you too. And on one particular night, I'm like, I got my head down in the pillow. And I look up with the eye that still can see her. And I see this gal, kinky haired, multiple layers, two sets of glasses, giant book with a book light. And I thought that may very well be the goofiest gal I have ever seen in my life. But I'm glad that she's my goofy gal. I'm glad that she's the mother of my children and the grandmother to my grandchildren. I'm glad that her life intersected my life. I'm glad that she became part of my story. I am glad that she's my wife. And then I had a bit of, dare I say, a revelation or even epiphany. And I thought, what in fact if she was my, instead of she being my wife, I was her husband. And I was the father to her children and the grandfather to her children, her grandchildren. And then in fact, it was my life that intersected her life. And I become part of her story and that I was her husband. Now you may think, well, that's just semantics. But it really wasn't. It was a complete change of the way that I had looked at our marriage relationship. I had looked at our marriage always from my shoes. My hopes, my dreams, my wants, my desires. It wasn't that I was selfish necessarily. It wasn't that we didn't have a decent relationship. But what it meant was I had always thought about me and my life. And so the next morning I told her, I said, first of all, I want to apologize for not slowing down long enough to think about our marriage from your perspective. And with what time God gives us, I want to change the way I view our marriage. And I'm not really here to give a testimony because in no way, shape, or form would I set Tammy and I up as the ideal. But I will tell you, it changed our marriage completely for the better. You know, they always say that if you walk a mile in somebody's shoes before, in fact, one guy said, before you critique anybody, walk a mile in their shoes, right? Because then you'll be a mile away and they don't have any shoes. I mean, that works out good, but from our perspective, I began to realize and understand that her life wasn't as wonderful and easy and cushy as she at times made it look. And I think even she would admit that she looked and said, you know, I thought being that the dad, the father, the husband, that all was going to be really easy, and it's not either. And so here's what we're going to ask you to do, and that is not to walk a mile, but to walk for a few hours in your spouse's shoes. And we're going to try to encourage you as our time tonight and in the morning goes on to do just that, because we're convinced that in addition to what God shares with us about the importance of marriage and what marriage looks like and what its ultimate goal and objective is, that seeing things through your spouse's eyes changes your marriage for the better. And so, like I said, we're not going to make you air your dirty laundry. We're not here to tell you about what all you're doing wrong. You probably already know that. You're just not sure on how to turn that around. We think one of the first and fundamental steps is for you to look through your spouse's eyes at your marriage, and hopefully you will be blessed by it. When we began to think a little bit about, well, what do you offer in a marriage seminar? Because somebody told me here tonight that they have been to, he says, I'll be the perfect person to attend the seminar. I've been to like 30. And I said, well, I wanted to ask how things are going in his marriage, but I thought, what if he said terrible? You know, I didn't know, but I'll be looking at him. He knows who he is, and I know who he is. I'll be looking over to see when he goes, you know, that'll be a good tip for me. But, you know, there's lots of people out there that do marriage seminars, either as a full-time ministry, as a part-time ministry, or as part of their local ministry. And so I wasn't sure what we had new to bring to the table other than perhaps that perspective change. And so I said, you know, really, if we're not going to do anything other than just relay what everybody else is saying, I'm not so sure that we're, if you will, very marketable. But we finally said, you know what, we're going to at least say these are some of the things we've done and these are some of the things that we've learned. And as we offered it, I said, there are going to be some truths that have to stay even though others are saying them. And we're going to really focus on some of those biblical truths, some of those God-given and God-designed things about marriage. But along the way, I realized that, you know, there are some things that, if you will, the problem in marriages are not what they know as much as what they think. In other words, what they think marriage is supposed to be rather than what they know about marriage. How they have conceived or more appropriately misconceived about marriages. And to our surprise, as we began to look at this, we found out that couples that had been married a very short period of time were struggling to the same degree that some people who had been married a long period of time. We were seeing couples who were beginning to divorce after 30 years, 40 years, even 50 years of marriage, and we began to realize that the problem was the same in many of those, and that was this. They had the wrong view of what marriage was for. It wasn't just about unfaithfulness. It wasn't just about abuse or addiction. But there were so many that had this expectation of marriage that wasn't being met. And when it wasn't being met, because it wouldn't be met, because it was a misconception, that the marriages came apart. And so before we can do anything new, we're going to probably have to clear the slate a little bit of the old stuff. And so what we did is we decided that we would identify five misconceptions that often occur in marriages. And by the way, this is not the fault necessarily of the couple. We have a world that is painting a picture of what marriage, what the relationship between a man and a woman is to look like, and it is skewed. In fact, even in what we would seem the most innocent of ways, the fairy tale. Think about it. For example, the fairy tale of a Cinderella. I think most of us, if not all of us, know the story, but if you don't, here's a nutshell version of it. Cinderella being raised by her ugly stepmother, ugly stepsisters, doesn't look like she has much hope. She's the maid. She's the laundry lady. She's the cook. She does everything around the house. She's mistreated. There's no real hope for her to find a man until word comes that there's going to be a fancy ball thrown by the handsome prince down at the big castle, and that from all the attendees, he's going to find a wife. And so on that particular day, the ugly stepmother, she dolls herself up. I mean, if you could put lipstick on a pig, that's what she did. And the two ugly stepsisters, they put on their very best because they're going to go off to find them a groom. And so Cinderella, she comes down the stairs. She's pulling on her rags. And they said, where do you think you're going? She's going, I'm with you to the fancy ball. Maybe the prince will pick me. And they go, not a chance. So they leave her behind. She's there crying. And all of a sudden, who shows up? Her fairy godmother. And she with a little bibbity bobbity boo changes everything, right? A little bit of magic, and all of a sudden her dress turns to something beautiful. In fact, birds and squirrels start dressing her. It's an amazing thing. Pumpkin becomes a beautiful carriage, and mice become coachmen. And she's going to go off to the ball, and she's given two things. One are these beautiful glass slippers. And this warning, being back before the last stroke of midnight, because it all undoes. And so off to the ball she goes. She gets there. She catches the eye of the prince and vice versa. They dance all night, much to the chagrin of everyone in the room, until bong, bong. She realizes it's almost midnight. She runs out of his arms, out of the door, down the stairs, into the carriage, heads off to home, leaving nothing behind but this beautiful memory and that one glass slipper. The prince picks it up and he says, whoever wears this glass slipper, it fits, is going to be my bride. Apparently only 1/6 and a half in the entire kingdom. But he goes from township to cottage and finally arrives at Cinderella's house. He puts the tries to put the slipper on her ugly stepmother. The ugly stepsisters, not a chance. Finally from the shadows emerges Cinderella. She says, I'd like to try, right? He puts that on her and it fits perfectly. And you know how the rest of that story goes. And they lived just like real life. They don't talk anything in that story about the mortgage that followed. They don't talk anything about miscarriages. They don't even talk about pregnancy. I've read those stories. I'm still trying to find out where babies come from in fairy tales, okay? But that's the story. And meanwhile, young men are hearing a different kind of fairy tale, a fantasy land, a far more inappropriate one, being painted by a world that is captured by immorality. I think of the world of pornography that paints an obscene picture of the relationship between a man and a woman. And when these two worlds get thrown together inside a marriage, women don't behave the way that young men thought they were going to behave. And young men don't behave the way young women. And it doesn't work out the way they thought it was supposed to. And they throw up their arms and they say, I quit, early on. And sometimes much later when they just can't take it anymore, the reason why is they have fallen victim to one or more of these misconceptions. So let's see if we can unpack and then untangle a few of these. First of all, and that is the couple that is looking for lust, not love. Now, before you get too carried away with those particular words, let me explain to you what I mean by that. There are couples that love all about what the external is. For example, beauty. Young men, young women, they pride themselves on their beauty, and if they don't pride themselves, they work hard to do something about it. Whether it's the name brand of clothing or the particular style that's going on, or it is the things that they do for their hair and for their makeup, and by the way, I used to say that ladies for makeup and guys for hair, but now it seems as if it's both ways. But the idea is that it's all about what I feel. And it's the feeling that I have. And then one day we go to bed with the prince or the princess, and we wake up the next morning with Shrek the ogre. Maybe you women have had a similar experience, right? The idea is this, that I don't feel it anymore. I'll hear a man say, well, my wife and I'm just not in love with her anymore. In fact, I've got a new love. A woman that I work with, and more often than not, my conclusion is, you simply have fallen out of lust with your wife because that's what your relationship was made of and what sustained it. But when you no longer felt that, now you feel something over here and you've just fallen in lust with another woman. And so we find that those individuals who are constantly looking for the feeling, when the feeling is, I don't feel it because you don't look it anymore. I don't know if you know this, but over time, beauty fades. The hair that holds on grays. The skin begins to wrinkle. Thank goodness we all still are able to stay in shape because round is a shape too, right? So we get to do all of that. Tammy and I were walking a few years ago in the famed Beverly Hills area down Rodeo Drive, and we had a lady that walked by us that had found the secret to everlasting beauty. As she went by us, we realized that all she was managing is if she had one more face stretching, her pigtails were going to be a ponytail. I mean, they just kept pulling it around because it doesn't stay. And when your marriage is based upon that feeling and those things that made you feel that way fail, then the marriage does too. We don't have the time to go over there, but in the most frightening book in the entirety of Scripture, Song of Solomon, you can always find it because it's the pages you've never really taken apart. But there is an expression there in which the bride-to-be is thinking about her groom, and she talks about wanting and desiring his kisses. There was a physical attraction. And then she talks about the affection, the emotional attraction. There's okay, those are both okay. But then she talks about his name or his character. And that's the thing that really is the most important. It's that which we need to advocate amongst our young men and our young women to develop character. Character is what's lacking so much in our world today, but it's the most desirable of all the characteristics. I appreciate it the way that one religious writer put it. He said, we need to encourage our young men and our young women to be the person that the person they're looking for is looking for. Does that make some sense there? In other words, when we look for character, when we develop character, when character is what matters, it doesn't matter if the rest fail. Number two is that they are looking for a soulmate, that is S-O-U-L, and not a soulmate, S-O-L-E. Tammy and I first really realized or quantified this characteristic in a couple when we were counseling with a young couple. They were not yet married, but they had no business being together. They were bad for one another. It's not so much that they were bad individually, but together, this just was friction and a fight waiting to happen. And one of them, I can't remember now which one it was, made the claim about, well, maybe you don't know the story of Romeo and Juliet. Everybody told them that they shouldn't be together. And no matter how many people told them that, their love just grew closer and closer and closer. And I said, I don't think you know the story of Romeo and Juliet. Because at the end, everybody's dead. Right? And so what we have is, it's written in the stars. It's destiny. They're my soulmate. That is, until I find somebody else. And then, they're my destiny. They're my soulmate. You know, I've looked through Scripture. I've considered human history. I've only found one marriage in all of history that was truly divinely orchestrated. Now, I'm not saying that God doesn't act providentially in the lives of individuals. When a young man or young woman praise, for example, for a godly spouse, that God doesn't work in the realm that God works. But what I'm saying is, if you had to think about it really hard, there's only one couple, Adam and Eve, right? God creates Adam, decides that he needs a suitable partner. He creates Eve. We don't have this record of this conversation in Scripture, but I imagine at some point in time, with nothing better to do, Adam asked one of those dumb husband questions, right? Eve, do you love me? And she goes, that's a ridiculous question. Of course I love you. Who else? Right? I mean, that was divinely orchestrated, but you and I have been given an opportunity by God to make a choice in that. And when we make that choice, then we have selected not our S-O-U-L mate, but our soul, S-O-L-E, our singular. Tammy was not my one and only because she was my soulmate. She became my soulmate when I chose her. And when couples think that there's some other giant chessboard of manipulation, instead of saying, no, I was allowed an opportunity, she was allowed an opportunity, we chose each other, and now the choice is made and it is set. Number three misconception, and that is that for many couples, they want a castle without the hassle. They just figured that there's not going to be anything bad now that they're married. Maybe some of you remember back to when you were first falling in love or maybe talking about marriage and you begin to conceive of, oh, when we're together, it'll be so much better. We will always feel loved. We will never feel unfulfilled, everything will work out. And then the first day back from the honeymoon, the wheels came off that wagon. Because you found out that both of you don't like Kraft macaroni and cheese and Spam when the other believed it to be a dining staple of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Nah, it's not true. I'll have to tell you the story of Burgers in a Bundle someday. But the truth is that all of a sudden a couple comes into conflict, and here's why. One's a man, one's a woman. That causes conflict. One's a this person, one's a that person. That comes in conflict. Put two people into a room, and guess what? They're going to find that they're not identical. And so on day 5 or 6 or 7 of the marriage, the alarm bells all go off and they go, oh no, we've had a fight. Tammy has received multiple calls from young ladies who go, I think I may have picked the wrong man. We just had a fight. Tammy goes, well, you've only been married a month, okay? And she goes, my parents never had any problems. They never fought. And Tammy goes, well, they do have a problem. One of them's a liar, because every marriage has problems. Some granted larger than others. And yet, even though I don't know anybody in this room for all practical, well, I know one couple and talk about problems, okay? But no, I don't know very many people in this room, but I can tell you that there are people tonight that are dealing with problems bigger than whatever yours are and finding a way to work through them with God's help. But it doesn't mean that if he has a problem or if she has a problem, that that means that they have a problem and they shouldn't be married. We've had a hard time sometimes expressing this to our own children, much less to a congregation or to a group of people at a seminar. And it's something like this. You know those guys that climb, and gals for that matter, that climb the tallest mountains, climb to Mount Everest or K2? As I understand it, they get helicoptered in or driven up to a base camp, and then they cross this rocky field and over this giant chasm, and then across a glacier and up a sheer face, and then as they move on up and the altitude increases, the oxygen decreases, and along with it the temperature, and along the way, at least on Everest, there's more than 200 people that are there on the side who have not made it and are frozen, but they could not recover their body. I mean, that could be a discouraging on a hike, right? But I have yet to find anyone that gets to the top and goes, huh, what a disappointment. That wasn't worth it. In fact, many of them, at the risk of losing fingers and toes to frostbite, will turn around and go back again time and time. Why? Because they've reached the summit. They've seen the view from what one could say arguably is the top of the world, and it's tremendous. But instead, we have young couples who run into a problem, and they go, I'm just through hiking. I'm going to move to a different mountain. And they start working up that mountain, and it has problems, and what do? That's just too hard. I'm going to go over here. They never reach the summit. All they do is just keep finding the hard, because they take half the problem with them wherever they go, right? So what we want people to understand is that just because you're married, it still snows in Colorado. Deep. It still rains in Miami. Deep. That tires still go flat. Cars still break down. There are still problems. Marriage does not fix the fact that we live in a broken world. But a broken world doesn't have to mean that our marriage is broken. There are going to be some problems. But I say this, there is not a problem in any marriage that cannot be overcome with the right amount of guidance from God and a willingness to work through those things. Next, or number four, a friend of mine used to say number next. That always meant I've run out of remembering what number I'm. Number next, and that is marriages that believe in endless excitement. That's what marriage has to be. Well, I'm tired. Well, I'm bored. You know, there's just not anything exciting in our marriage. Here's how it works. First of all, we start dating, and there's a little bit of excitement, anticipation as we get to know one another. And then we decide we're going to get married, and there's the anticipation, all the planning, the excitement about the wedding day. I mean, the wedding day itself, it's a day that ends in cake. I mean, how more exciting can it be than that? We go through all of that, and then, well, we don't want this to quit. You know what we need to do? A honeymoon, right? 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, 14 days of endless excitement in some exotic paradise. That's what we need to do. And then we get back to the work the first Monday after the honeymoon, and somebody says, well, the honeymoon's over. Oh, how are we going to maintain excitement? Well, you know, we need a series of anniversaries. We will do the wedding anniversary. We will do the birthday anniversary. We'll have the holiday anniversaries. We'll have the anniversary of the first time we ever wore blue together. You ladies are the queens of anniversaries. I think of that poor guy that one day comes in, head to work, grabs a handful of bacon and a coffee, low-carb diet. He kisses his wife on the forehead, is heading out to the car, and she goes, "Have a good day. Remember what today is." And he goes, "Oh, no, what is today?" Because we always do. He looks in his planner. He goes, "I don't know what today is, but I better take care of it, cover my bases." He calls the florist and he says, "I need 24 roses sent to my house for my wife," with a note that reads, "On this our special day, love me," right? And 24, because he sent 12 for Valentine's Day and didn't want to get caught on this being a bigger one than that. He gets to the office, does his work, goes out at lunch and thought, "You know what? I remember that she mentioned that she wanted this little tennis bracelet at the jewelry store. It's a big day. I'll get that. She doesn't play tennis, but I guess I'll get it for her anyway." Ladies, explain that one to your husbands on the way home. But so he gets this tennis bracelet, and then he calls and says, "Hey, I know you're out picking up the kids, but I'm going to take you to that fancy restaurant tonight you've been wanting to go to because, well, this is our special day, right?" And so he goes on about his business. He's headed home. And he remembers the last time he tried to take her to that restaurant. She says, "I can't go to that restaurant. It's too fancy. I don't have anything fancy enough." So he pulls off the road. He goes to this little boutique. He buys her an outfit, thinks he's got everything covered. He gets home. They are fanned out like the NBC peacock are those 24 roses. There, the sentimental note, "On this, our special day, love me." She comes walking to the room. I mean, she is glowing like the Madonna. Not Madonna, the Madonna. And he drapes that piece of jewelry over his wrist, right? And she is without words. And he said, "Did you get my phone message?" And all of a sudden, the light dims, her countenance falls. She goes, "I told you, I can't go there. I don't have anything fancy enough to wear." Ta-da! And she goes, "You have thought of everything. You are incredible. You are the best husband ever. And I will not forget this Groundhog Day as long as I live." Because we're looking for ongoing and continual excitement. What's the next exciting thing? As if marriage is a Ferris wheel on at the greatest amusement park ever. Let me tell you what an exciting day is. A number of years ago, Tammy got up in the night to use the bathroom. As she occasionally will do, I hear a thud in the bathroom. I get up, I go in the bathroom. She's curled down in the floor, and I said, "Tam, are you all right?" And she doesn't say anything. I said, "Tam, are you all right?" No response. I kneel down next to her. I roll her head back. Her eyes have rolled back in her head, and she is unresponsive. And for what seemed like hours, though I know it was only moments, I'm going, "Tam, Tam," but my mind is racing a million miles an hour. I think of an aunt who died of a cerebral hemorrhage when she got up in the night and it ruptured. I think practically, how am I going to call 911? How will I get the door unlocked? What will I tell her kids? She's too young. This can't be the end of this. I'm getting no response from her. She claims later that she could hear me but could not articulate anything. And finally, her eyes rolled like a Las Vegas slot machine back into her head. And with this gentle, sweet voice, she said, "What? I can hear you." She had two near-death experiences that night because she about gave me a heart attack too. It turned out, folks, that it was nothing, anything serious, but here's what I learned. An exciting day is any day that her shoes are next to my shoes, even if we're doing nothing exciting at all. Finally, and that is, it has to do with the purpose of marriage, and we're going to unfold this a little bit as our time together goes on, but there are individuals who are looking for happily ever after. They're looking for everything that feels wonderful. In fact, sometimes when there is a couple and they're struggling, one of them will blurt out something like, "Is it too much to ask?" Or, "Wouldn't God want me to be happy?" And I think the response of God is, it's too little to want merely happiness out of marriage. If you want happiness, go get ice cream. It'll make you feel happy. But if you want something bigger, something more, something better than just happiness, I would consider pursuing holiness over happiness. That our relationship with God certainly produces a healthy marriage that does produce happiness, but that sometimes things are unhappy. But when we're pursuing holiness, we don't just search for happily ever after. We find what God really wants for us, and that is a happily forever after. That in marriage, there is something bigger than just the relationship in this life between one man and one woman for that lifetime. That it is part of a much grander plan. A plan that I believe gives marriage a more significant role than we ever thought it did. It gives us a greater sobriety about marriage. But most importantly, that when a marriage is what it's supposed to be, not only do the couples, the individuals within that relationship or in that couple benefit and are blessed, but there is something beyond simply their marriage that happens. And so as we spend our time together the rest of this evening and tomorrow, we're going to talk about what that is. And by our wrap-up time tomorrow, we'll try to make it as clear as we can about what that big something really is. Living by those misconceptions are going to disappoint us. Simply being satisfied with being happy is such a shallow goal. Instead, let's look for something more that I believe will bless your marriage beyond any stretch of your imagination. As David said, we want to try to spend some time being a little more focused. It seems silly to have a marriage seminar and ask the couples to spend part of the time apart from one another. Tammy and I found a few years ago when we hosted our marriage seminar on a cruise ship that locking up a couple in a small room on a ship for 5 days, either they came out with their problems all worked out or one of them came out dead. That, I mean, you just lock you up, you'll figure it out. But we do want to spend some time with Tammy being able to talk to you ladies. And guys, I'm sorry you drew the short straw on this, to spend some time with me. And so we're going to take a brief break here. By my clock, we're going to take about a 10-minute break. That'll let you get a drink or relieve yourself or whatever. Ladies, I'll ask that as you can, move quickly down there to the family room so that Tammy can get started and we can get you guys out of here on the promised time. I do need one favor from you ladies. I saw we filled in nicely here, but I noticed that several of you plopped down where you normally sit on Sunday. I appreciate, David, you might understand this, and Dan, you as well, how so many churches leave rows for whoever responds at the invitation wide open. We're not going to have any invitation tonight, so you can feel free to tell your husband that he has your permission to move a little closer down front. Because some of the guys look at me like, if I move and she comes back and I'm not where she left me, I'm going to be in trouble. Tell them it's okay and have them to move down here. So let's take 10 minutes and then we'll have our breakout before we come back in here for a little bit of a fun, interactive exercise. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We appreciate it.